All right, thanks a lot for the introduction. Also, thank you for the invitation. Not sure whether you know, but in 94, when I came as a young postdoc to interview at Livermore, Toronto was my first stop at a conference, and then I moved on to Livermore. And then I never left, so we did experiments on the Nova laser on a small interruption. We went to Rochester for a few years to do experiments at Omega laser, and then we completed the NIF, and ever since I'm doing experiments on the National Ignition Facility. So that's what I talk about today, megajoule experiments on the National Ignition Facility on the road to produce a microscopic star in the laboratory. And that's the goal of the National Ignition Facility program. So the NIF facility is a national facility. It was built in Livermore to have three functions. One is to demonstrate inertial confinement fusion in the laboratory. Another one is to do HED experiments, or high energy density science experiments. And about 20% of the allocation is for basic science, where every university in the world can basically apply and do research. So, and I will talk about the first part. I'll give you a very rough introduction to the principles of inertial confinement fusion. I will remind you of many processes that you heard of in undergrad physics. And then I will talk about the beginning. That means the very first experiments that we did, where we put away or we put to rest some critiques that we had before we even started, and we showed that we're really on the way to demonstrate inertial confinement fusion in the laboratory. So we successfully completed the so-called Hohm energetics campaign, and we demonstrated an ignition Hohm drive and symmetry with 1.3 megajoule of laser energy into the target. So 1.3 megajoule, many of you are probably doing experiments at the joule level. Rochester laser facility is of the order 20 to 30 kilojoule level. So when we were going to 1.3 megajoule, you could see right away that was a quantum step. And in order to successfully do this without destroying the facility, we had to go through very, very great details of engineering. And I will allude to that in my talk. I will show you that we have done new physics as well. We've demonstrated capsid symmetry, a symmetric ICF implosion, imploding by a factor of 20 to 30 in diameter. And we have achieved that with a new laser wavelength tuning technique. That was completely new physics that could only be demonstrated on NIF. And we had computer codes that predicted effects, and we applied on NIF, and it worked. So those capsids are driven with a radiation temperature of 300 eV and achieve ablation pressures of 100 megabar. So that's significant. 1 megabar is typically considered high energy density science physics. So we have a factor of 100 above that threshold. And we achieved about 87 to 90% coupling. That means we have 10 to 30% total losses. And I will show you that this is an acceptable area to work with. And then recently, as of this year, this fiscal year that started in October last year, we have done experiments with thermonuclear fuel. That means what we've done, we've actually used heavy hydrogen isotopes, deuterium, hydrogen, and tritium. And first of all, we did this in order to study DT fusion processes in laser experiments. But you can see we use a lot of hydrogen and a lot of tritium and very minute amounts or traces of deuterium. And the reason for that is we wanted to have a diagnostic-rich environment. That means we want to study fusion while our detectors are still working. And I will show you if we would now go to 50-50 mix, we would destroy half of our equipment. So this was a way to have a diagnostic-rich but neutron-pure environment that allowed us to study what's going on in our experiments. And so I will show you experiments on 14.1 MeV DT yield. I'll show you ion temperature measurement. And I'll show you how the capsule is performing at this point. So we call it layered implosion, or that's implosions with nuclear fuel. So they're happening now. So that means we are now at the beginning of the ignition campaign on the NIF. So for further reading, there are a bunch of papers that have described the inertial confinement fusion process, so primarily by John Linnell, Bob McCrory, and Mike Campbell. So John Linnell is still the chief scientist at the NIF, and he has a bunch of other papers here. One of them I had the honor to co-author, and then we had the recent paper of the symmetric capsule implosion on NIF. Coming out last year. So let me first give you a general introduction or remind you of some principles. So here's the big picture. Here's what you need to have fusion power. You need a target factory, You put this target in a fusion chamber, and then you drive it. It means you heat it up, you compress. And the driver can be a laser, can be a heavy ion beam. You produce fusion, you have a steam plant, and you convert the energy into electricity. And the goal is to produce or to demonstrate roughly 1 gigawatt. 1 gigawatt is that's what's needed to power a major city in the US, such as San Francisco. It may not be enough for Toronto, so we have to build a couple of these plants for this city. So we want 1 gigawatt out. So, but we also want to continuously operate the facility. That means we should probably produce 1.3 gigawatts to feed 0.3 gigawatts back into the system. So then we have our driver say it's 10% efficient. So this is what we've got to drive our target. So 0.03 gigawatts, which is equivalent to a 6 megajoule driver at 5 hertz. And then right away you see that we need a target gain. That means when we get this energy in, we need to amplify the energy by factor, or we need to amplify the process by factor 100 so that we get 3 gigawatts out. And then we have like 43% efficiency, and we are back to 1.3 gigawatts. So right away, you see, we need a target. If you put a megajoule in, we want 100 megajoule out. Or if you put 5 megajoule in, we want 500 megajoule out. So that's where we want to end up. This is the final goal. How we do this? So this is fusion, nuclear fusion. What is happening in nuclear fusion? You use deuterium nucleus, a tritium nucleus. You fuse the two together by bringing them close to each other to so that they produce a helium particle. And then it decays, so you get a neutron out at 14.1 MeV. This neutron is carrying the energy. It leaves the target. It will interact with the target chamber wall. So we heat up the target chamber wall. This is the heat you can use to convert to electricity. And then you have 3.5 MeV alpha particles. So what are you going to do with that? So let's look at the sigma V as function of temperature. So first of all, you need to get this process going. The way to get this process going is to make it warm so that the coolant barrier can be overcome and you can fuse. Now, to make it warm, you compress material. So you heat a hot spot. And now you get this process going. Oops. So you produce a hot spot, and now you have alpha particles. And what you want to do with those alpha particles, you want to use them to heat the material that is there. That means you want to stop the alphas, and you want to launch a nuclear burn wave. And when you do that, you get to here. You propagate burn into the main fuel. That means you're burning in a nuclear burn wave about one-third of the material that surrounds our dense hot spot. And so you reach extremely high temperatures and extremely high densities. So in the laboratory, we will here produce a temperature that's a factor of 3 times higher, and a density also a factor of 2 to 3 times higher than the interior of the sun. So truly, this would be a star in the laboratory. So let's think about this. So if you want to stop alpha particles, we can look at the density of the material. So let's look at materials of about a tenth of a gram per cc. So what is happening is, in order to stop the alpha particles, in order to heat something up, you need about a plasma or material of about 30 centimeters. So you need a real ball of DT fuel. If you got that, and if you burn all of that, here's the energy out. That's a hydrogen bomb, or equivalent to a hydrogen bomb. So this, you cannot contain this reaction. You don't want that. What you do want, you want to go higher in density, to about 1,000 grams per cc. Now you have a small amount, a small radius, a micron object. And if you burn the fuel here, you get 12 megajoule. That's where you want to operate. And then you want to operate at high rep rate in order to produce power. And at the same time, you have a reasonable driver to heat it up. So the volumetric heating is too wasteful. Instead, what we do, we use the so-called hotspot approach. That means we are compressing a balloon. We produce a central hotspot where we get the fusion processes going. Temperatures of the order 10 kilovolts, you're about 100 grams per cc. It's 30 microns, so it's a fraction of the diameter of your hair. So you create alpha particles here that gets stopped in the main fuel that sits around the central hotspot at about 1,000 grams per cc, so 1,000 times solid density. And now your fuel contains only 10 kilojoules, with a driver of 1.3 megajoules. This is the NIF. This is the NIF driver. So this is what we want to create. Okay. This is when you heat up a whole ball of materials, when you heat up everything to fusion temperatures. Here in this approach, we only heat up the central hotspot so that the fusion processes get started here, and the alpha particles heat the rest of the material. So here's how it would start, 2 millimeter. This is the size of the fusion capsule we are using right now. So it has a capsule ablator on the outside, has a DT solid. This is all nuclear fuel. One cell of it we want to burn. And you have some DT gas in the middle. And then here's what happened. 10 hours later, it will be compressed to this. And this is real. This is data. So there are two approaches from a driver side to get there. In inertial confined fusion, we call them the indirect drive approach and the direct drive approach. So you're close to Rochester, New York, so this is being pursued over there. In Livermore, we are pursuing the indirect drive approach to inertial confinement fusion. And what's happening here is you convert your laser light first to X-rays or soft X-rays in a so-called hole arm. And those soft X-rays impinge on the fusion caps in the middle. So our outer ablator is absorbing the X-rays. And then you're starting to compress. I just showed you some real data where we actually achieved that compression. And now you see, in order to compress and in order to get to the hotspot temperature of 10 kilovolt, in order to get the process launched, we roughly need a ROR of about 3 gram per square centimeter at 75 micron diameter, which primarily means that we can, at those small amounts of mass to start with, we can get a yield of 500 megajoules. So what is the physics? The physics is, as I said, a central hotspot. So the temperature is high in the middle. The temperature goes down. And the hotspot is surrounded by a dense shell, by a dense shell that holds the nuclear fuel. So this is the density, so it goes up. So the typical cold main fuel density has an aerial density of 2 to 3 grams per square centimeter. So think about this for a second. We have DT. We want to compress this, and we want to compress this in a thermodegenerate way. That's the most efficient way to compress material. That means you don't put energy into processes where you raise the entropy, where you would need more energy. So we go to thermodegenerate. That means you only need 10 to the 7 joules per gram to compress it. Or at least you want to stay as close as possible to this number. And then when you compare this with the energy we can get out from DT fusion, that means this is much less. That means the energy is needed to compression is only a small fraction of the total energy budget. So in order to get there, we can calculate the implosion velocity, which is about 2 times the ignition margin of the energy that you have in the fuel. And right away, you can calculate you need an implosion velocity of 360 kilometers per second. So this is a fastly compressing material. Then you can go through your rocket equation. Then you find that your exhaust velocity must be 1.2. 10 to the 7 centimeters per second, or 120 kilometers per second. So now what that means is you need an ablation pressure of 100 megabar. And an ablation pressure of 100 megabar will be reached when you have a radiation field inside your whole arm of 300 electron volts. Once your whole arm does this, we will be able to compress fusion capsules and to be on our way to produce a microscopic star in the laboratory. So that was the first step we needed to do. So where do we do this? We're now going to the West Coast. This is a picture of an aerial photograph of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. It's about a square mile, 1 hour off the coast. You can see the fog here sitting over the Pacific. So it's 1 hour from San Francisco. Down here is the biggest building in town. It's the National Ignition Facility. But it's still a building. It's probably smaller than most of the power plants you know. So here it is. So this is all laser. And as Robin said, it has 3 football fields. So it is big. I was born in Germany, so 2 soccer fields. All right. So NIF concentrates all the energy in a football stadium-sized facility into a cubic millimeter. What this means is truly high energy density science, right? You put all the energy into it. This is a fusion Hohm. It's about a centimeter here. That means you want to create matter temperature of 10 to the 8 Kelvin, radiation temperatures, I mentioned 300 dB, density 1,000 times solid density, and pressures are 10 to the 11 atmospheres. And that's our goal. Producing a sun in the laboratory, a microscopic star, with a few microns diameter. Okay, so here's the laser system, NIF laser system. Here's when you visit Livermore, I will give you guys a tour, and you're going to walk through the laser bay. It's a long walk. And there are two laser bays, laser bay 2, laser bay 1. They're each housing 96 laser beams. And the laser beams are being transported to the fusion chamber sitting here. And we fire shape pulses onto our target. So this is a typical laser pulse shape. The NIF was built in order to accomplish 500 terawatts. At the moment, we do experiments at 400 terawatts. And eventually, we may be able to go to 550 or even higher. So remember, at any time or any second on this planet, the total electrical power we are producing is all of between 10 and 20 terawatts. So this laser pulse is truly powerful. And it's shaped. That means you can control the compression with this pulse. It has 1.8 megajoule of energy, and it operates at a wavelength of 351 nanometers. That means it operates in the blue. So let me show you this movie. So this is the NIF control room. Everything will be, is operated from here. So there's a viewing window for the physicists around. So you can view them while they're doing a laser shot. And right now, the shot director is counting down a laser shot. And now you launch a laser shot. It's happening here in the MOR, Master Oscillator Room, where you have a little fiber laser from a telecommunication industry, where you launch those laser pulses. So they are nanojoule level. And those laser pulses are now being distributed in the two laser bays. And now you amplify them up. You spatially shape them. They were already temporally shaped. And I told you they're about 10 to 20 nanoseconds, so they're like 10 feet long or 20 feet long. And they go through the main laser. Now they get amplified in that main laser beam. They go here four times through this main amplifier. In order to do that, you have to change the polarization of those 40 by 40 centimeters beams, the so-called plasma pocket cell. Now you are in the beam tube. Now you follow the lasers. They get switched out. They get amplified again. Now you go through the pinhole. You clean up the laser beam, so that only the average intensity survives. The high intensity part is stopped in a pinhole. And now you go transport it into the so-called switchyard. Now you switch the beams around and distribute them in the upper and lower hemisphere of the NIF chamber. So this is needed for the indirect drive configuration. Now they all line up at the same time, arriving at the target chamber here. They get frequency converted first into the green, then into the blue. You hit your target. Well, we are not done yet. The target is in the middle. Here's our centimeter. That's our Hohm. The light goes in. We're heating up the Hohm walls. You're creating X-rays and lots of those. And now we are here at 7 billionths of a second and so on and so forth. So the target sits here. Now you start to significantly ablate the material that surrounds your DT fuel. You're compressing by Newton's third law, and boom. Okay, so now I tell you the beginning. We started in the fall of 2009 to do the first experiments. So this was the slide that we have shown a lot in reviews. And people thought we were like 5 years away from getting there. So but we've already passed this step. And I will already tell you what the results of the next steps are in a little bit. In any case, this was what we said we would do. We said we would get to 300 eV. And we've already gone to 301 eV, plus minus 6 is the absolute error bar. We wanted to have a symmetric implosion, and we measure the symmetry of a capsule implosion in Lagrange polynomials. So the P2 over P0, this is the first mode, must be less than 10%, we are around 5%. We don't want hot electron preheat, because if you preheat your fusion capsule or your fusion material, it's hard to compress it. So you have some limits. So these are the limits. You want to be less than 2.5% of hot electron preheat. And right now, this, which also translates to about a kilojoule of hot electrons in your target, with energies above 170 kilojoule, we're about a factor of 2 below there. That we're also a factor of 2 below the limit in the foot. And on, there's also X-ray preheat. We also want to limit that. It should be less than 20%. And right now, we are 14%. So those are our basic requirements, and we've accomplished them all. And here's how we did it. As I told you earlier, we have laser beams heating up our whole room. They're actually the so-called inner and outer cone of beams. The inner one sits at 23.5 and 30 degrees with respect to the whole room axis, and the outer sits at 44 and 50. And we can measure the laser energy that goes in, and we can measure the light that is back reflected. So, for example, on the outer beam, we have an outer cone backscatter detector that measures lights coming back into the beam line and surrounding the beam line. We also have one detector on the inner beam. We measure the conversion into soft X-rays by having a broadband X-ray spectrometer. We call it Dante, named after Dante, who looks into the inferno. So our detector looks into the whole room inferno, measures the absolute X-ray emission. We have a gated X-ray imager to measure the core implosion. And we have neutron time of flight detectors to measure neutron production. And we also have a static X-ray camera to look at the X-ray data. And this is just one example of data that we've accomplished. This is an example of a megajoule shot. This was the last shot we've done in 2009. And since then, we've gone to 1.3 megajoule and broke the 300 eV bar. But this is how it looks like. You typically have a laser power. You can see it's shaped. It's like four bumps. The reason for four bumps is to launch four different shocks. And all those shocks compress the material to 1,000 times solids. Remember from your thermodynamic class, you can, with one shock, you can only compress a factor of 4 to 5 times. So if you want to have higher compression, you need like four shocks. So we do that. And this is our radiation temperature that you measure. And here's, in this case, it was 285 eV. In order to get to those, to these nice conditions in a whole room, you have to apply a lot of techniques to your laser beam so that the laser light sticks into the whole room. So one is smoothing by spectral dispersion. We also use polarization smoothing rotation. I will get to that in a second, actually. And we also change the wavelengths of the inner and outer cone of beams. And I will discuss that in greater detail. Oh, sorry, I'm back. So this is a hard X-ray image. This is a detector that looks now, an X-ray image that looking into the whole room. You see the outer cone of beams irradiating the whole room wall. Here's the inner cones. And you can, another X-ray detector is measuring the X-rays that come from the whole room wall, shining through the whole room. You can see the outer beams and inner beams striking the whole room wall. You can also see this little dot here, and that dot used to be 2 millimeter in diameter, and that's our implosion. And what you can see, there's a 70% contour line. And you can see this is a fairly round implosion. It's 14% in our P2. At that time, our requirement was 20%. So we 14% met the requirement. Since we've done so well on this, we've now made the requirements more stringent to have margin in other performance parameters. So right now, our goal is to be less than a few percent. And I'll show you how we get there. OK, so in any case, this is the platform where we do our fuel implosion, our nuclear fuel layered implosion. So as a picture of the target chamber, you will not get to see this very often. This is it's a little bit too dark. Can we lighten this up a little bit? This is a 7 meter radius, so it's a huge chamber. And of course, you cannot have any windows in the chamber under vacuum, because if it cracks, you get sucked into the chamber. And so only when the chamber is under air, we can have a window and you can look in. So if you happen to visit Livermore at that time, don't pass on that opportunity. It's a very impressive view. Our target sits at the end of this target positioner here. And we have two target positioners, and we get into that a little bit. Here's our static X-ray imager that measures the X-ray, the hard X-rays in a time-integrated way that we see the outers and inner beams of the whole wall. We have another X-ray detector that measures implosion characteristics. Here's an optics inspection camera. So after every shot, we can actually look at different optics and see if some optics are at risk of damaging. We can check them out. And down here, you see a near backscatter imager plate where we measure the light coming back from a target shot. And we measure the light hitting this area with absolutely calibrated detectors. So this is an example of a suite of diagnostics that we have fielded. And I guess we are back to lights. Okay. So this is our X-ray detector that we have applied. Here's what we are doing. We have a detector fairly close to the target. It's been put on the DIMM, like a diagnostic board, and we get it close. And then we have a pinhole array, and the pinhole array is imaging the capsule implosion into the detection plane. And now you have a microchannel plate detector, and you have a microchannel pulse running along. And that's how you can measure the implosion at different times. And that's how you measure the time when it's maximally, when you get the emission, and also how the emission is varying as a function of time. And besides this time resolved detector, we also use the real estate around it to measure the hard X-rays in a time-integrated way, but at different energies. So, for example, we call them here, it's an image plate detector, and here is measuring an implosion shape at 9 kilovolts. Trust me, on my computer, you can see more. Okay, here's a backscatter detector. I showed you the image, the scatter plate before. You measure the light on the scatter plate. Here's a picture of the calibration map. Here's a picture of real data. And then you can analyze the image. And you also measure the light that goes back into the beam line. And remember, we frequency triple close to the target chamber. That means the light that comes back is close to frequency tripled, or maybe even the green. But the last turning mirror is transmitting all that light because it's a monomer turning mirror. So we have an absolutely calibrated detector down here as well, where we measure the absolute energy, power coming back, and the spectra. From this detector, we know the coupling of laser light into the whole worm. We have a hard X-ray detector that measures the X-ray preheat and the hot electron preheat. And this is an example of a two-electron component into our whole worm. Simply X-rays that hit a fluorescer, and then it measures the fluorescence with photomultipliers. And that tells us the amount of the hot electron population in our target. And finally, we have the Dante detector. Dante is fairly simple. What it is, it's really an aperture. There's an X-ray diode, and you put a foil in front of it to filter certain X-ray regions. And you can also combine a filter with a mirror to have a better defined X-ray region you're looking into. And then you have a diode and a scope, and you measure the X-rays. So with all those detectors in place, we felt ready that we would to do real experiments. We did those first on empty whole worms. That means there's no gas inside, no fusion capsule inside, just to see that the detectors are working. And they did work, so we had those are shot empty whole worms. They shot up to 600 kilojoule. Right at that point was a factor of 20 more than previous facilities. And we had to synchronize all 192 beams. We had to show that we can point them with the 64 microns IMS pointing capability. That means if you have your hair, you can point on the left-hand side or right-hand side of your hair over hundreds of meters of travel of laser light. So we did all this. We fired them into a whole worm, and you can see X-rays go up if you put more energies in. Here's a 90% conversion efficiency curve with a theory. So we felt we are close enough. We actually surpassed the 300 eV barrier. Our detectors work. We are ready to go. And this is the target we shot. So this is a 1 centimeter fusion target built to do an experiment. What you can see, this is a fuel line. So this fuel line, you put the nuclear fuel, or in the first experiments, we put high-pressure helium into the fusion capsule. You see another line here? This line is filling the whole worm with gas. And you have to fill the whole worm with gas to avoid that plasma from the wall that you're irradiating is hitting the capsule. So that's why we have a gas-filled whole worm. You can also see this little diagnostic hole here. That's a 400 micron diagnostic hole. We image the fusion capsules through this hole onto our detector. This is the laser entrance hole up here. It puts the laser beams in here. And you can see all this stuff here. Those are aluminum shields. And the reason why we have those aluminum shields are the silicon wafers. Those silicon flats cool this target. So they make it cryogenic. So we use those silicon arms to get to 20 degrees Kelvin. However, those are flat surfaces. So if we have done what other people have done, switching on your laser, firing at maximum energy, we would have destroyed the laser right away. Because if you have a flat surface here, the laser light comes in, a small amount of that light would be reflected into that direction and would kill the other beam line. And you cannot avoid some of the light hitting here because there's always some unconverted light in the chamber that will hit some surfaces. Even though it's a small amount, it's enough to destroy beamlines. For that reason, we had some aluminum plates around like this. And now when the light is hitting this area, it gets dispersed all over the place, or distributed all over the place, and the light level is low enough below the damage threshold for the laser. Okay, so this is how the tile looks now when we do the real experiment. We put this experiment into a shroud to protect the target from the chamber environment. Remember, this tile sits at 20 degrees Kelvin, so it's cold. If your chamber vacuum is not as good, you get the atmosphere, you have ice buildup on your target. And now instead of interacting with the whole warm wall or with gas, you interact with ice. So that's how we had to put a shroud around it. And here, now you have to align your target through those windows inside a shroud to 50 microns. So this is truly a precision experiment. And actually, what here is the top view. You can see those dimples here, aluminum dimples. This laser entrance hole, that's a fusion capsule. And now, this is the target with the shroud open before we're closing and pumping it down and cooling it. So this shroud will be pulled back 7 seconds before you start shooting. And then when it's open, then you shoot. So this configuration allows us to do experiments at temperatures of 20 degrees Kelvin. The pressure is 420 torr inside the whole room. Inside the capsule, we have a pressure in the first experiments of 2,634 torrs. Later on, when we go to nuclear fuel, we have a different metric to measure that. And at that time, the ice buildup was very small, of the order of 100 nanometers. And I'll show you that we are now struggling more with ice buildup because we're going to even lower temperatures. I'll show you that in a minute. This is what happens when you shoot. So you have this little, everything here is gone. So you see the copper shields bend up. So you need the copper shields in order to cool this target down. Remember, you also have to insulate your target from IR radiation from your environment. So that's what those copper shields are there for. At this time, we felt we can remachine them and reuse them. We did that a couple of times. Then we increased the energy, so now it's getting somewhat hard to see, I think, on this projector. But okay, maybe the next one shows it more clearly. Yeah, so now at this time, now we weren't able to reuse them anymore. Actually, this guy ripped. This was for a megajoule shot. So this was actually a nice energy meter. Actually, now when we go to 1.3 megajoules, those guys sit flat on the tile position. So in order to get to 1.3 megajoules, we had to do a lot of physics, and we had to learn a lot. I told you one example was we need to learn how to protect our laser from damaging it. Another thing that we had to learn is what is the optimum way to couple laser energy. So that means we exercise Hohm tuning parameters. That means we exercise the laser tuning, the pulse length. So we experiment at 11, 13, 16, and recently 20 nanosecond long pulses. We vary the energy, we vary the peak power. We vary the cone fraction, that means the ratio of energy in the outer cone of beams relative to the inner cone of beams. We change the laser wavelengths, we change the laser intensity. On the whole one, we change the size. We also change the materials. We also change the way where we let the LAH, the laser entrance hole, where the laser beams pass on its way to the Hohm wall. That was actually a bad idea, so I won't talk much about this. So we also changed the gas-filled species. We went to helium. That was good. I'll show you that. We also changed the density. On the capsule, we tried a high-density carbon. That's another word for diamond. And down the road, we will use beryllium as well, which should be more efficient capsules for implosions. We also changed the Hohm to capsule diameter. So all those parameters were tweaked and were tested on our way to the first few layer experiments. So this is one of the first implosions. That was actually August 2009. Everything worked great. We got on the bulletin of the American Physical Society meeting. So everybody loved that. But life was not always good. So this was our first implosion. I just showed you that. It's coming nice and round. It's compressing well. But this was for warm gas-filled Hohm. As soon as we were going to cryogenics, what you can see is we call it a so-called pancaked implosion. This is an oblate implosion. That means it's not compressing in a symmetric way. We don't drive enough in the equatorial plane. We only drive sufficient from the top and bottom part. So what's going on? This is our Hohm here. This is where the capsule sits. This is the implosion that we got, or pancake. And now we look at the backscatter detectors. And what we find is this is our inner beams, we find 24% SRS reflectivity on those beams. That means we are losing a lot of energy of these beams. The outer ones are doing fine. We only lose about 2% by SPS. So we had to counteract those scattering losses. So one way to do it is just simply increase the energy on those beams to make up for the 24%. However, that only gets you that far because eventually you're going to damage your laser. You cannot get any more. So instead, we opted to do physics. What we did, we changed the color of the laser beams. It means we changed the wavelength of these guys with respect to those guys. And here you see, by doing so, by changing the wavelengths, by only 1.3 angstrom, we got a round implosion. And now our diagnostic says the scattering losses on these guys haven't changed much. The inner beams still reflect about 25%. The outer cone of beams now reflect even less than it did before, simply because we transferred power from the outer cone of beams to the inner cone of beams to make it round. And now the SPS is coming from the interaction of the beams with the Huon wall. The intensity has dropped, so did the SPS drop. And here's a calculation that we had ahead of time before we were doing those experiments that we have now tested on NIF. So here's what's happening. You have all those laser beams that are overlapping in this area, the so-called laser entrance hole area. So when you calculate the intensity variation, you get a so-called fringe pattern, interference pattern. Those are the hot speckles or the speckle physics that are related to the lasers. The dark stripes are the fringes. Now you have the ponderal motive force in your plasma. What's happening is where the intensity is high, the electrons will be pushed out. And they get pushed to areas of low intensity. And what that means is you're setting up an optics grating, a true plasma optics grating with varying density in your plasma. Now you have a grating that simply changes the color of your laser light so you can scatter off the gratings and you can transfer power. This is our calculation. And what you can do is you can scatter, since you go through plasma resonance, you can scatter power into those beams or out of those beams. Of course, we had to opt to scatter power into those beams to make it more symmetric. So that's what we did, and that's what worked. So this was our first implosion. Then we changed the color, got a little better. Then we changed it more, and got much better, and got nice and round. This is what we need to be below 20% at this time. Now we feel we can be below 10%. That was the beginning. That was the start. However, we still didn't feel that great about it because we had 25% scatter on those beams. So we did a bunch of tests in order to reduce the scatter. The first test we did, initially we had a helium hydrogen fill in the whole room. We changed it to pure helium. That helped right away. So we dropped the scattering losses down to 15%. We also changed the way we do smoothing on the beam smoothing. In the early days on the inner beams, we had the polarization rotators aligned this way. That's two of the beams are polarized like this, two of them are polarized like that. And then when they overlap, you have a factor of square root of two intensity reduction in your hot speckles. However, what happened is those two don't talk much with each other. So that's why we went to a checkerboard geometry. So now they all talk with each other in a nice way, and that gave us an additional reduction of the SRS losses. And now we cranked up the intensity by a factor of two, and we were still doing much better than here. So now felt ready to go to higher energies and higher powers without too much scattering losses, and here it is. So now we are at 650 kilojoule. Again, we start off with a pancaked implosion, or oblate implosion. At the same laser energy, all we did is change the color of the light, of the laser lights, by a very small amount. The way to do it is we have a fiber laser, and it operates at 21 degree Kelvin. All we do is we change the temperature to, or Celsius, sorry. All we do is we change the temperature to 17 degrees Celsius. And we change the laser wavelengths, and we get a round implosion. So that's what was published in Science this last year. And that's the way, that's the reason why we believe we can get perfect symmetry in these type of implosions. Okay. At the same time, we have also developed calculation models that can calculate this type of behavior, this type of symmetry. It's called a full-scale radiation hydrodynamic model. And that model did not only, at the end, calculate the symmetry right and the behavior with wavelengths, but it also calculated a bunch of other observables right. For example, when we transfer power from the outer to the inner beams, the brightness of the outer beams you know, our X-ray detector should go down. And you can see it actually does go down. That means the power is really reduced. And that power reduction was correctly calculated by LastNex. The same is the X-ray dive as measured by our detector. The total X-ray dive should also go down. It was also correctly calculated. So now we had an experiment, a bunch of experimental observables, plus radiation hydrodynamic modeling, that now describes our whole environment very well. And with that, we were going up to 1 megajoule. So this is what happens. Here are the outer beams, here are the inner beams. This is the total power. And then we had 0.5 megajoule, now 650 kilojoule. Then we went to 1 megajoule. And going through all those efforts of beam smoothing, we kept it close to 90% coupling, and at the same time getting the radiation temperature to 285 eV with an error bar of 5 eV at the peak. So this is when we stopped in 2009. Since then, we've continued and have done more implosions. And this is one of the most recent shots. It's just a few weeks ago where we had 1.3, 1.25 megajoule into our laser. We fired it into the hole and we achieved 300 eV. This is the range of ignition radiation temperatures that we need, and we get there. And here's how it looks like. So this is our nice and round implosion. And this is about a 400 picosecond observation window. And the symmetry is within requirements. You can see down here the symmetry numbers of the order of less than 10%. With this accomplishment, we were then ready to go to thermonuclear fuel. And this is a whole other challenge, a whole other level. And I'll tell you why. The first level is paperwork, because you put tritium in. And when we stopped doing experiments last December in 2009, we thought we could do experiments starting up with the spring again and get going with ignition. However, it took from December to September to prepare to be allowed to get tritium in the chamber. So it's a one month worth of work of actually doing work and 9 months of paperwork. And then we were allowed to put tritium in. Okay, and so we did 9 months of planning, basically. So we planned very well. Primarily, we planned to do experiments with low amount of deuterium so that we don't blow our detectors away. And we wanted to predict the performance of capsules that are filled with 50-50 DT, because that's what we're going to use to get ignition. And the way to predict the performance, we did a bunch of simulations. We did simulations of capsules that are filled with this amount or with this type of fill, this nuclear fill, and then we did simulations with that type of fill. And what we observed is when you multiply the yield from a dotted implosion with the so-called downscatter fraction squared, you can predict once you get above 1 that we should ignite and burn in a DT implosion. So what is DSF, downscatter fraction? That's the amount of electrons that have changed their energy. You know, neutrons that have changed their energy. The neutrons get born at 14.1 MeV. I told you that earlier, just by fusing D and T. So now they're on their way out, but you have a dense shell surrounding your hotspot. So the denser the shell, the more scattering occurs in the dense shell, and the neutrons lose energy. So they're now at around 10 to 12 MeV as opposed to 14 MeV. So those are the downscattered neutrons. So the more you get of the downscattered neutrons, the denser your shell is surrounding your hotspot. And of course, you need to be dense in order to launch a burn wave. So clearly, this is the parameter that describes how close you can be to launch a burning wave in your nuclear fuel. And this is a challenge. So those THD capsules, at the end, we opted to work at 6% DT, deuterium. And the DT yields then, the maximum DT yields in a perfectly tuned implosion can be of 10 to the 15 neutrons. However, look at our X-ray detector, 10 to the 13. You can see all types of stars here. This is actually from a direct drive implosion. And those stars are neutron events hitting your detector. So if you go to 10 to the 15, this detector already is not usable anymore. So you have to put more money into the system buy better shielded detectors and get going. And that's what we did, and this is the implosion that we have that we are now describing. So instead of, this is still our 1 centimeter hole worm. This is still our 300 EV hole worm that I told you earlier. But the capsules have changed. So now it's a capsule that has CH out here, has a few layers of germanium to absorb the high energy X-rays. And then it, over here it sits, you have ice. This is our THD ice, this is our nuclear fuel, sitting here on the inside of the layer. And this is the nominal value is 68 microns of ice. This is, if you burn 1/3 of that, we get 50 megajoule out. However, in order to get to that, to this DT ice, you're facing some challenges. Those are the triple points for THD, 17.4 Kelvin. Oh, sorry, this is the normal shot temperature. Our triple point is 18.95. The shot temperature is 1.5 degrees below the triple point. That means you have to layer this guy at like 300 millikelvin below the triple point. And what that means is you have to wait for 17 hours to get a nice fusion layer that you can then shoot. So here's our target sitting in a in our filling station, and there's an X-ray view. And we cut those windows into a hole worm to observe how the capsule is being filled. And you see this liquid at the bottom here of the target? This is our THD fill. So this is liquid. And now we can measure the triple point by simply rising the temperature. And eventually, this height is not growing anymore. That means you have put everything into the liquid. And that tells you how thick the final layer will be, and also tells you what the triple point is. And that this type of measurement controls the amount of nuclear fuel that you're shooting. That means by doing that, you will never shoot too much fuel and blow up your chamber. So then we layer. That means you wait 12 to 17 hours at a temperature of 300 millikelvin below the triple point. And now what you see, this is our capsule. This is the germanium layer in the CH. And this is the hydrogen sitting on the inside of the capsule. And what happens is, the beauty is, it layers on its own. Just where it's cold, that's where the ice goes. And there's tritium inside, that means there's latent heat, that means the layer will be smooth. And this layer was a really beauty, and we shot it. And this is our new cryo system that allowed us to do this shot. And here's our implosion. This is now a THD implosion. That means an implosion with nuclear fuel. And it came in a little earlier than the implosion that was using helium mixture. And you can see that it's implosed a little earlier, but the burn width is pretty much the same as the previous one. So right away, you can see that that this implosion is not optimized. In order to get to ignition, this burn width has to be reduced by a factor of 2, and you have to get more excess out. However, this was the first shot we started off. That's what we did. We measured the neutrons that were coming out. So right away after the shot, neutron results have been reported. For example, here we have 7 neutron time of flight detectors. This is simply when the neutrons are arriving at our detector. And here, for this shot here, you have 2 × 10^13 neutrons, and here you see how those neutrons are varying. You also have a copper piece close by, and the copper piece it gets activated by the neutron capture. And then you look at the decay of activation, and you get numbers that are very close to the neutron time of flight detectors. You have another nuclear detector, so called magnetic recoil spectrometer, that also quotes a yield, plus a downscatter fraction. So those are the primaries, and these are the downscattered yield. And then you produce tables like this, and then you show those tables to the Undersecretary of Energy. And he's very happy that the neutron yield is going up from one shot to the next. And what you see is, this is 2 × 10^13 yield. We expected at this time 4 × 10^13. And if once we are at 1 × 10^14, we would be ready to do a nuclear fuel DT implosion. There's a fairly good chance to achieve or to start seeing effects of alpha heating and maybe even some burn. At the moment, you can see you're still a factor of 5 away. So let me skip this slide because of time. And let me show you this one. This is now the Newton yield as function of experimental ion temperature. This is DD yield in so-called SimCap implosions. Those are the capsules implosions that have helium with traces of deuterium. You see, when you calculate the performance of these capsules, we get like 50% of the calculated value, which is, we call that great performance. This was our first THD shot down here. It had a few percent of the calculated yield, which we call a failure. The second shot, we got 17%. That was based on a P-shot calculation. The push-shot calculation, once applied, this number will probably even go up to like 25%. So after the second shot of experiments with nuclear fuel, we showed that we're on the right trajectory up. And I told you, if you're above 10 to the 14, we're on the range where it matters. And the nice thing is, our colleagues at Rochester have, of course, used our experimental results, put them on slide, and analyzed them for us. They put their experiment down here, 2009. This was our first THD shot. This is our second THD shot. Here's where the jet sits. And my NIF, supposedly, we want to get over here. This is where ITER wants to operate. And you can see after two shots, it's nuclear fuel. Here's where we are. So we are like one order of magnitude away from a burning plasma regime. So I think with this, I have truly convinced you that we are on the road doing experiments to achieve nuclear fusion. And I told you in the beginning also that nuclear fusion is only one fraction of the time allocated on NIF. Another fraction is high energy density physics, but 20% is for basic science. And here are the basic science projects that people have been interested in. So one is studying planetary interiors. One is astrophysical hydrodynamics, laser plasma interactions, and doing nuclear physics. Now, of course, you're all invited to come up with your own experiments that you want to do on NIF. Submit a proposal. The next call will be in 18 months or so. And become part of the academic user teams on the NIF. And with this, I think I want to conclude and take your questions. Thank you.